The Silent Master, a lecture by Ed Abdel. A longtime member of the Theosophical Society, Ed Abdel is manager of Quest Bookshop in New York City. He is also currently a national lecturer for the Theosophical Society in America.
Do you think it would be fair to say that every human being wants to be happy? That every one of us, each person here, really wants very much to be happy? It doesn't matter whether we're theosophists, whether we're interested in the spiritual life, what our sex, color, creed, whether we're couth or uncouth, or somewhere in between like most of us, we all want to be happy. And each human being searches for happiness in some way. Because we're conditioned, all of us, by nature of our birth, if nothing else, we seek first that happiness laterally, and we seek it in the sensate world. And so we head out in search for the career that's going to make it for us. And we head out for prestige, which will also make it for us. And we look for a lover, which will make us so happy. And we look for friends and money and power, even if only a little bit. And in the end, we could sum it up by saying we look for the fulfillment of our desires. Is that not common? Is that not almost universal? Now, sooner or later, we begin to discover in this quest that not only do the pleasures fade out, that the new car isn't so titillating anymore, that we're in the divorce court with a lover, or whatever, it fades, something fades, and it dies away. And we've got to look some more, don't we? And we have lots of laughs on the way, and we should. I have plenty, as most of you know. But nonetheless, behind the laughs, there's still the search, isn't there? And so finally we discover not only do the pleasures go, but lo and behold, so do the pains. We think when something hurts, it will hurt forever, but it doesn't. If nothing else, I understand cremation cures it. But nonetheless, it goes away, doesn't it? And finally, we've sort of exhausted the search in the sensate world and say to ourselves, can't find it there. So then we say, maybe the spiritual life, and we turn to it. But you know, from having been conditioned for so long to search laterally, we're apt to do it again. And we start looking for the spiritual in external objects of adoration. This is not bad. I'm not putting moral judgment on this, please. So we look for a god, for a master, for the latest channeled entity who will give us comfort, assure us that all is well, and that we'll live happily ever after. Or we go into interior images, interior feelings, aspirations, and put our lot there, our confidence, our faith, our trust there. But really, whether exterior or interior, they are still objects of perception, are they not? And our motive, at first, though perhaps mixed with something much deeper that we have not quite grasp. Our motive at first is still to meet our personal need. And then we discover that even though that has its place and maybe has taken us a step beyond the sensate search, it too passes away. And there is still that slight gnawing feeling in the heart of incompleteness, which no God, no master, no object of perception can satisfy. The eternal has escaped us. It's just at such a critical juncture that we may begin to suspect that there must be an eternal background to the temporal, subjective, and objective foreground in which we live. How would we recognize change in one sense if there were not the changeless? That clue starts us in a different direction. But what is the eternal? Surely everything changes. The pleasures, the pains, the jobs, the friends, and as I said, cremation in a way ends it all. Everything changes. So the question remains, what is the eternal and how do I reach it? The question, in a way, reveals the problem. Because we say, what is the eternal and how can I reach it? Do you hear the duality? There is I reaching for the eternal. This is the problem with language. It's one of the reasons I'm not going to be able to really say what I want to say tonight. I have to allude to it. The question, as I said, what is the eternal, implies that I am seeking for it. And our task is actually, I'm suggesting, to discover that there is no I and there is no it. That's the tough part. The Theosophical philosophy, as I'm sure most of you know, insists that there is one life and one life only. And that while you and I may feel quite separately from one another, quite distinct, and in one particular sense, perhaps we can say we are, distinct from one another and distinct from the world around us, we are really simply modifications within one indivisible reality. Just as the waves are temporal modifications of the sea. The sea represents, in this particular analogy, the eternal. The waves represent you and I and all creatures and things. That sea at times is quiescent. It hardly moves. It gently rises and falls almost imperceptibly. The great breath in the analogy of the Hindus. At other times, that sea is turbulent, even violent, with an incalculable number of waves, some enormous and powerful and even dangerous, and others gentle, lapping, quiet. Almost infinite number of waves. But can we scoop a wave out and say, here's the wave, and there's the sea? Or is the wave but a modification of the very sea itself? It's very hard, perhaps, may even seem nonsense to say that a rock and the air are essentially the same thing. Any twit can tell you that's not true, right? More difficult, maybe, to say that a revered master and a mosquito are the same thing. but from the point of view of this philosophy, true nonetheless. I've known some mosquitoes who didn't seem like masters to me. But if one thinks about that analogy of the wave in the sea, which has been used by many speakers, I'm sure, throughout the theosophical world, because it's such a good analogy, one gets maybe a little grasp of that. But there's another way of looking at it, a different analogy that I think perhaps also throws some light, especially on this apparent tremendous difference between rocks and air, or mosquitoes and masters. And that is the simple example of H2O. We have ice, we have water, and we have steam. They are extraordinarily different. I'd love to have an ice cube in my soda pop in the summer. I wouldn't want a blast of steam in it. They appear so different, don't they? Totally different, extremely different. One hot enough to cause severe burns, and the other cold enough to give you frostbite. One hard could hit you on the head and cause a lump, and the other one gaseous, and the middle one, which we drink to keep us alive. But they're all modifications of one. So those two examples perhaps give the basis, or at least lead toward some understanding, if one hadn't thought of it before, of how that might be. Now, the difficulty with us is that that consciousness has a tendency to identify with the form, for lack of a better phrase, with which it is associated. And that produces the illusion of separateness. We've identified with the wave. And it is that illusion which we must destroy, I think, that illusion of separateness, and we must do it by our own efforts. That is not to say we are left without guidelines. The secret doctrine, whose centenary we celebrated last year, provides us with what might be called a metaphysical map of the universe and ourselves. And the voice of the silence, whose centenary we celebrate this year, provides us with instructions for following that map to the unspeakable eternal reality within which, by which, and out of which we first did radiate. Moreover, there are teachers, great ones, masters, rishis, it doesn't matter their name, the saints of humankind, who have followed that map and point out the way. But neither the map nor the teachers can provide the details. They cannot provide the steps. In a way, the map doesn't have any roads on it. It only has signposts pointing in a direction. In the words of H.P. Blavatsky, the teacher can but point the way. The path is one for all. The means to reach the goal must vary with the pilgrim. Now, why should that be? It's because the journey that's to be taken is not an outer journey. It's a journey of inner transformation. It's a journey which is taken by probing very deeply within our own mind and consciousness, not picking the brains of the person over there, although maybe that's useful. But the probing has to take place inside, and it has to be serious. Oh, it doesn't have to be dull and deadly and humorless, but you have to mean it. And it can be great fun as well. But the journey is interior, in the mind, and beyond it. So there are no roads, only signposts pointing the way. We make the roads, as the Spanish poet said once, by traveling. Not the road someone else has made for us. Yet, while there is a near infinite number of roads, a different one for each human being, there is only one direction. I cannot emphasize that too much. It is my firm conviction. I do not mind if others here have quite different ideas. But I feel convinced from what I have read and thought and listened to from others, there is really only one direction. And that is away from the personal toward the impersonal, from self to non-self, from the many to the one, from the fleeting to the everlasting, from the mutable to the eternal, from the personal ego to the universal self. Quoting Blavatsky again, to reach the knowledge of that self, thou hast first to give up self to non-self, being to non-being, and then thou canst repose between the wings of the great bird. Aye, sweet is rest between the wings of that which is not born nor dies. Again, seek in the impersonal for the eternal man. And another quote from the secret, from the Voice of the Silence. Struggle only with the personal, the transitory, the evanescent, the perishable. And the Master K.H., in one of his letters to Mr. Sinnett, said this to him, learn to be loyal to the idea rather than my poor self. Now, to move away from the personal to the impersonal does not mean that we should be indifferent to the needs of others. It doesn't mean cold, impersonal, uncaring. The word impersonal does not mean uncaring. In fact, the very first step away from the personal mentioned in the Voice of the Silence says, to live to benefit mankind is the first step. Very different from uncaring, this impersonal. And if we do that, we seek the good for its own sake, instead of the good for what I can get out of it. There's a big difference. We seek what is right for its own sake, not for our sake. And we do what is right, and this is the hardest part of all, regardless of any personal consequences. We usually think of our own neck. But it's suggested that we should think of what's right rather than our own neck. She says further, kill out love of life, but let that not be for thirst of life eternal, but to replace the fleeting by the everlasting. So the suggestion, all of these suggestions that are made in the Voice of the Silence, have you noticed? I've just mentioned a few. Do please read it if you have never. Meditate on it. Think of it. Keep it by your bed or whatever. Refer to it frequently and just let the ideas sit in the back of your head, because they really gradually come to life. But she says, kill love of life. That is, kill the personal craving for pleasure, the craving for sensation, the craving for experience. This is my interpretation. It's not in her notes, please, but this is the way I see it at this reading. And then adds, let it not be for thirst of life eternal. That is, not for the craving of personal spiritual pleasure, the second trip we take looking for pleasure, but to replace the fleeting with the everlasting. That is, to extricate ourselves from the identification with the mutable sensate world and to realize the unity of all in the eternal one. Now, that eternal one is not perceivable. If there's a perceiver and the perceived, it isn't one, is it? It's two. It's me and that. The knower and the known, again, would be two different situations. not one, must be merged. It's been said by so many mystics in so many different ways. And HPB indicates that idea of the knower and the known being one. She says, that which in thee shall live forever, that which in thee knows, for it is knowledge. That which in thee knows, for it is knowledge, is not a fleeing life. It is the man that was, that is, and will be, for whom the hour shall never strike. So the Eternal One is not an object to be sought after. It's not a God to be worshipped. It's not a power to be acquired. It is silent, unmanifest, yet the ground of being. Beware, therefore, of those teachers who point toward personal gratification, toward personal satisfaction and pleasure. Beware of the ego's demand for power, whether worldly or spiritual. Beware of any path which suggests that an everlasting joy is obtainable in the ever-changing phenomenal world. The end of every such path is sorrow. That which is eternal cannot be seen any more than the eye can see itself except through reflection. That which is eternal cannot be seen, it cannot be personally acquired, it can only be alluded to by metaphor and paradox. It can be known only by intense inner effort and search, by reflection, by a distillation and synthesis of all experience, and by letting go of the personal. That which teaches us is not an external master. That which knows is ever silent, yet it speaks. It is the silent God, the silent speaker, the silent master, the one without a second.